Okay, good morning, good to see you all. We are on Daf Chav Dalet, the final Daf of Masechet Mako. And before we start, I want to thank all the sponsors throughout the year who have helped support the bagel breakfast that I know so many enjoy. I also want to thank Sam in his absence and all those who have stood in on the weeks to pick up the bagels and have them brought here. I know it's not easy to get up earlier than one wants to go and schlep to the bagel store. So thank you to all of those who have done that over the course of the year. And enjoy the bagel, because I don't know if you're going to get another one till after Sukkot. We'll be taking votes at some point over the course of the next few months as to which Masechet you'd like to do next year. So far, we have finished Masechet Tanit. Last year, we're about to finish Masechet Makot. I will leave a few lines over at the end for the official Siyum, which will take place on Shabbos afternoon, second day Shavuos, and the Kiddush will function as a celebration in part of this accomplishment as well. So, Masechet Makot, three chapters. Very briefly, for the context, we started 8 months ago with the discussion of two scheming witnesses who come to court with the intention of somebody being punished for something they know they did not do. And the central two themes of that first chapter was our natural instinct that justice can be dispensed on earth is shattered. It is impossible. We can never really dispense the equivalent reaction to misdeeds on earth. If somebody does something wrong, we think, oh, you know, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, a limb for a limb, we can do it. And we said, even in the case when it seems most obvious, where you've got Im Zomim, which is whatever they intended, you do to them. So there are exceptions to the rule. If they wanted to make somebody a halal, you can't make them a halal. That is a unique dispensation. If they wanted somebody to end up going into exile, you can't force somebody else to go into exile. It is a specifically tailored punishment. So we're stuck. And sometimes Makos is just where you end up. That's how the Masechet started. But sometimes we are we struggle to articulate justice on earth, and sometimes lashes is the most brute force version of us expressing disappointment and the hope at rehabilitation, but we can't really undo the mistakes that have been made on earth. And we had one piece of agadata in that first chapter, which described a rabbi hearing the screams in a cemetery because of somebody that was sentenced to death that shouldn't have been because of him, and how he relented throughout his life, praying that in the next world he would be atoned for having sentenced him to that form of justice. That was the only agadata in the first piece. In the second chapter, we didn't have any agadata. This has been an agadata-less almost masecha, other than this coming Amud. Tanit was maybe 40% agadata, so it was very different style and substance than we've had this year, which has been very dense, often very subtle legalese we've had to parse our way through. So I praise your patience and your commitment. That second, after we had that first chapter, which again outlined the impossibility of justice, that was the first half. The second half was, not only is it impossible to really respond to a crime in an appropriate way, but we can never really ascertain who's committed crime. We said truth is impossible. We discussed how witnesses come together. What do you trust witnesses? What happens if one witness has supreme eyesight and can see across miles on their own? Can we trust them? Can it join together with another witness from the other side of the field? Can they be a group if they're not standing next to each other? What happens if they're standing at the same window, but one has to look after the other? Can they join as a group? How do we ascertain truth? And we establish truth can never really be ascertained on earth. We just approximate and we do our best. And that first chapter ended with Akiva saying, if it were up to me, no one would ever be put to death. And his rabbinic respondent saying, well, if it were up to you, there'd be a lot more murders going on then, because how would we ever disincentivize murder? And that's how the first chapter ended, with everybody saying, look, I know it's not great, I know it's not brilliant, but this is the best we can do. Anyone seen that movie with Kevin Spacey and about the death penalty? I can't remember what it was called, where they trick the system and he basically kills himself but makes it look like it was a murder, because he wants to protest the death penalty system. Nobody? All right. I can't remember what it's called. Maybe it was a dream, but Steve's nodding, so either we shared a dream or we saw the same unpopular movie. That was the first chapter. The second chapter suggested, so how do we carve out society if justice is approximate and truth is impossible. We should just go and live in the mountains by ourselves and avoid other people then. Because I'm going to get punished for something I didn't do, or I'm going to get punished in a way that I don't deserve. And the second chapter essentially made the argument for two things, which is that's not plausible. We need other people. To thrive, we need to be together. And the whole premise of exile or the Ir Miklat is that to live, v'chai, you have to be surrounded by people and a market and society. You have to be surrounded by those who can teach you and learn from you. Society can't function if everybody lives as Tibetan monks in the hills. You need to come together. That was point two and point three. So how do you cope? You have to be intentional about life, deeply attentive and aware to the world around you. And that's why we have this discussion of unintentional error. Shogeg, you end up going, how do we classify shogeg? What are the exceptions to shogeg? What if you're doing a mitzvah? That came up in our third chapter. If you are the flogger of Bet Din and somebody passes away as a product of your lashes, you don't go to exile because you're engaged in a mitzvah. Even though it wasn't an accident, it was unintentional, you still don't go because the mitzvah overrides. And we had some details along the road there, what Arim Miklat looks like. And that was the end of the second chapter. And the third chapter has established, now that we know justice is approximate, truth is impossible, intentionality is the key. We have this third chapter dedicated to laws that have nothing to do with interpersonal harm in a direct sense, but assume that society will flail and collapse if they're not adhered to, which is self-restraint when it comes to appetites, whether those are sexual or food-related. Self-restraint when it comes to temporal obligations, waiting, having patience, saying, this is my food, it's Maaseh She'ni, and it's not treif, I can eat it, but I can't eat it yet. And you have to wait until you get there, till we get to tearing your skin, tattooing your skin. It's my body, we said, that's true, but there are obligations that pertain to you, even though no one else is being harmed. Until we got to the point where we're being thought police, essentially. You can do eight crimes in one moment if you're warned eight times in one act, and the law will pierce the barrier of your brain in order to accuse one of a crime, in order to keep society together. The last mission that we did last time, which began with the idea that even if you're chayv kares, Malkus can remove that punishment from you, which the Gemara said, who went to heaven and came back and told you that, that God abandons kares if you get malchus? And they said, well, we get that through drasha. We look at the Torah, we can discern God's will. And if you get malchus, the assumption is you have been rehabilitated. And we had the discussion about how can you avoid malchus? And the suggestion is if you experience any level of shame, we abandon the punishment. So if you, and the easiest way, so to speak, to abandon this punishment, we've said, if somebody ends up wetting themselves or soiling themselves in a state of deep nerves, that shame is enough to abandon the punishment. We said, even just fleeing, if you're tied to the post and then you run away, we assume the shame of you having fled your punishment is enough for us to say, mission accomplished. We're not going to kind of bring you back and hit you for the sake of it. You've experienced the shame of fleeing before justice, which again sets up an odd incentive for criminals, but the assumption is that society will see you as incapable of standing up to your punishment, and you will experience that shame. And that was the first line of that Mishnah. And then we had the end of the Mishnah, which started some ruminations on the purpose of mitzvot. And we finished with Chanan Menakasha, with Kodesh Baruch Hu Lezachar Eid Yisrael. God wanted to purify or purge the Jewish people, which is what all these mitzvot are. And the premise of Chanan Menakasha's statement is, we think, why is God being so fussy? Why can't he just say, be good, turn the other cheek, love your neighbor? What are all these details about shaking lulav and lighting candles and wrapping your arms in leather? Just what are all these mitzvot for? So Chanan Menakasha says, is to purify us, to purge us, because these mitzvot make us better human beings, better moral agents on earth. And that's the premise we finish with here, that if you want society to flourish, knowing that justice is approximate and truth is impossible, recognize that actually these mitzvot will make society function and flourish and make truth as close as possible and justice avoidable to the extent we can. So the end, in the green at the top here, I'll do the first four lines of the previous stuff. The first four lines of the previous daf. Rav Simlai, this is one of the most famous Agaditas. Rav Simlai said, Darash Rav Simlai, 630 mitzvot nevim l'moshe, 630 mitzvot were told by Moshe, 365 correspond to the days of the solar year. Of matayim v'arbam shemayin of ase keneged evar shel adam, and the 248 positive ones correspond to the limbs of human beings. It is a od agadata, 613 mitzvot. This is the only place in Shas where this appears. It's one of the only places in rabbinic literature it appears, a 613. The history of why this became prevalent and understood as universally true is complicated, and it involves the Karaites to some degree. It wasn't until the medieval period, the coming up to Shavuos actually, that Karaites started writing the 630 mitzvot, and it became an incredibly popular activity. What do you do on Shavuot ritually? On Sukkot, what do? You shake the lulav, you sit in the sukkah. What do you do on Pesach? You got the matzah, you got the maror, you got korban pesach. What do you do on Shavuot?
Nothing. Cheesecake,
right? So we found ways to compensate, but ultimately there's nothing. And one of the ways that people would celebrate was, let's do poetry slams. Let's do 613 mitzvot. Let's itemize them based on this teaching. Let's isolate what they are and discuss Jewish life. And the rabbinate group, which is the opposite of the Karaites, the rabbinites said, well, we can't let them get hold of Jewish tradition and start articulating what the 613 are, so we're going to have to participate, which got the more traditional Jewish groups on that bandwagon, so to speak. And Rav Sadia Gaon was one of the first ones to do it, says in his introduction, there's no particular reason to isolate 613 in kind of historical terms, but everybody's enjoying this, so I'll do it too. And the Rambam probably made it the most formal in his Sefer HaMitzvah by saying there's 613, and the Rambam Nachmanides in his pushback against Maimonides saying you've forgotten one and that one's not included, says, I also am not sure about this whole thing because I don't know historically who decided there's 613, other than this Agadata at the end of Marcos, which is an Agadata based on the solar year. And when does Judaism ever invoke the solar year in anything? The limbs of human beings. And it's Rav Simlai. Either way, that's some history where it all starts here. It's essentially speaking to the all-encompassing nature of Jewish law. We've said the solar year, meaning we don't have to compensate through leap years. This is entirely comprehensive Jewish law. You are bound every day by negative prohibitions holding you by restraint. And the negative prohibitions correspond to your limbs, meaning there is no part of your life that is not touched or bound or inspired or driven or fueled by commitment to your faith. That's essentially the theme of that Agadata, which will lead us through to the end of the Masechta. The Agadata continues with somebody saying, hold on a minute, Rav Simlai, I understand what you're saying, but where do you get that from? Amrab Hamnona, the last line of that daf. Micra, what is the source? Anyone know what the source is for the 613, the biblical verse? Torah Tzivalanu Moshe Morashah. Moshe commanded us a Torah as an inheritance. And Torah, Gematria, what is the Gematria of the word Torah?
611.
Excellent. Top of the page, Chaf Dalet, 611. Shitme'ah v'chadzrei have. It is 611. Anochi v'lo yem ipnei gvura shema unum. And the next two we got from God himself. So Moshe gave us 611. And God gave us the two, because those were the two historically we heard and coped with. And then we asked Moshe to take over. Full stop. And this Amud, which we'll do until the bottom of this Amud, is a central contention. 613 is a lot. I think I may have mentioned in the past the Archbishop of New York once came to Lincoln Square Synagogue when I was an intern there for a Shabbat morning drasha, so to speak. And he spoke after davening and he began by saying, I don't know if any of you have been in the new Lincoln Square Synagogue, the lighting on the ceiling. Anyone know how many lights there are?
613.
Oh, there you go. You remember. 613 lights. And I can't remember who it is, but one of the members, who's a mathematician, designed it so that it looks random, but there's a perfect pattern on the ceiling. And he said, somebody told me that you've got the same number of lights on the ceiling as you do commandments, like 423. It's unbelievable. And everyone was like, I don't know who gave you that information. But he said, it's unbelievable. For me, 10 is quite a lot. So I don't know how you do all of those. And presumably, Lahavdil, the prophets felt the same way. And this stuff is suggesting that each one, over time, a number of prophets said 613 is a lot. Let's find a way to capture the spirit of Jewish law in less principles. So you've got first in the blue, you've got David who says, let's get it down to 11. After the yellow, you've got Yeshayahu who says, let's get it down to 6. Micah gets it down to 3. Yeshayahu gets it back down to 2. Amos and Habakkuk get it down to 1. So if you want to know, if you could summarize Jewish law, the spirit of Jewish law in one principle, what would it be? We're going to end up there today. And it will not be V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. So this is a different spirit than what we see. What is the most important verse? But what is the spirit of Jewish law about? So, Bar David Amadim al-Achasre. David says, let's get it down to 11 principles. And this is just a citation of Psalm 15. Dechtiv, it says in Psalm 15, Mizmor David. David sang, who makes it up to your sacred tent? Who makes it up to your sacred mountain? Meaning, who is good, God? And he's now going to give 11 principles. And if you fulfill these 11 principles, you make it up to Har HaBayit. You get to the sacred place. Number one, Holech Tamim. Go in authenticity. Number two, Paul Tzedek. Work justly. Number three, Dova Emet Bilvavo. Speak truth in your heart. Number four, Lo Ragala Lashano. Don't have slander. On your tongue. Number five, lo aselere ura'a, don't do wicked to your friend. V'cherpa lo nasa al krovo. Number six, do not bring reproach upon your family. Number seven, nivza be'inav nim'as, hate or detest that which is despicable. That's seven. Number eight, yireh Hashem yichabed, respect those who fear God. Number nine, nishpala harav lo yamir, swear against wickedness and don't give in to that, don't change your mind. That's number nine. And number ten, kaspo lanatam b'neshech, don't lend with interest. Number 11, Shochad al Naki lo lakach, do not take a bribe innocently. Ose ele lo yimot lolam, if you do those 11, if you do those things, you will never be shaken. You will be steady, you will stand firm. And again, you could make a large discussion why these 11, of all the important things, not taking a bribe seems quite key, not lending with interest seems like a very random law to include in the 11. So the Gemara is now, until the end of the narrow lines, is going to enunciate what all these 11 refer to.
David seemingly violated some of these.
Who did?
David.
In what way?
Lo asalare hua.
Mm-hmm. I'm asking you so that I can drink my coffee.
Right.
Yeah, go on.
Right, so, right. Story with
Uriah. Yeah, I think that's a good question. David is, as a model preacher, thinker, and penitent, not an angel, but it's interesting to consider his own biography as we go through these. That's true. So let's itemize them. Holach Tamim, what does David mean you should walk in authenticity? Ze Avram, you should be like Abraham. And this is key, because when we say, who is the first Jew? I think I mentioned in my high school career, Jewish history, my final exam, the first question was, who was the first Jew? And it was multiple choice. And it was Abraham, Samuel Ferrell Hirsch, or Donald Duck. So it was a very hard exam. And he knew he couldn't put Avraham and Moshe, because that would be a complicated question. He had to put Avraham, so, and then two other completely impossible options. Was Avraham the first Jew? You would say so, yes. So you agree with my high school Jewish history teacher. Technically speaking, the word Jew comes from which word?
Yehuda.
So it's hard to call the grandfather or the great-grandfather the first Jew. So what do we mean when we say he's the first Jew? It's the first Hebrew. So he's the first Hebrew. So are we Jews or are we Hebrews? Are we Yisrael? Are we B'nai Yisrael? So we couldn't say he's the first Israelite, because that's his grandson. So his great-grandson is Judah, his grandson is Israel. So it's very hard to identify Abraham as either of the first of those figures. He's the first Hebrew. And what we're getting here is, yeah, he is the first Hebrew. We turn back to Avram. We don't say, you know what, Har Sinai, Avram was airy-fairy. What was Avram into? Hospitality, fighting on behalf of the vulnerable. You know, that's Reform Judaism. We're interested in 613 mitzvot. And that what we're getting at the end here is, no, back to first principles. Avraham is our first model. Hospitality, caring for the vulnerable, fighting for justice. Those are principles that define through the mitzvot that encompass and bind us. And we shouldn't forget that. As you saw a piece last week, which was tongue-in-cheek to some degree, Rabbi Sacks wrote in 1989, saying, "I'm a fundamentalist and I'm proud of it." That's something he would not have said 20 years later when he wrote a number of works against fundamentalism and wouldn't have even made that remark tongue-in-cheek. But in that piece, he said, "I'm a fundamentalist in the sense that I define my religious life and all its obligations by commitment to a series of fundamentals. And if we forget what the fundamentals are, we can become so warped by our commitment to loose obligations, we forget what we're doing. And the fundamentals, you have to remember, what are the fundamentals?" And this is what this duff is about. What are the fundamentals when we're talking about makos and punishment and justice and commitment to not eating maaseh sheni early and not breaking the bones of the Korban Pesach? We're getting all hung up on these small techniques. What is the whole point? And we're saying everything starts with Avram, who walks with authenticity. Number two, Paul Tzedek. Who is the good worker? Kon Abba Chilkiyahu. And it's also worth noting that in this last duff, we're going to get a series of heroes or models, people to look up to. Abba Chilkiyahu. So, backstory quickly. Abba Chilkiyahu was working in the field. A friend came up to him and said, "Hey, Abba, how you doing? Good to see you, Abe." And he said, nothing. He was working. He's not going to interrupt. He's saying, "I'm being paid by the hour. I'm committed to work." So that's Paul Tzedek. That's the example. You should be committed to your commitments. You should speak truth in your heart. Going to Rav Safra. Like Rav Safra. This is a story I'm sure many are familiar with. Rav Safra was saying Kriyas Shema, davening, and he had a big jewel in his possession. Someone said, "Rav Safra, I'm going to buy that jewel off you. I'll give you 1,000 for it." And he didn't respond. I thought, oh, he's a stiff negotiator. 1,500. Nothing. 2,000. And by, the next 5 minutes, "I'll give you 10,000 for that jewel." And Rav Safra turns around after 10 minutes and says, "Actually, I was davening, and as soon as you said 1,000, I'd committed. Yeah, that's a good price. And when I'm finished, I'll give it to you. And well, I was just davening, and I was waiting, and you went up to 10,000. And in theory, would that have been improper or illegal? He committed freely to 10,000. He says, "Truthfully, I committed." That's speaking truth in your heart. Again, what does that speak to? That's inner restraint. This is, again, imagining what is the theme beneath Torah law? Inner restraint, walking with authenticity, committing to not breaching contract. If you said, "I'm going to work by the hour," and I don't know how many of you are either connected to contracting or have had contractors, and you know, "I'm paying you by the hour," why are you taking a 14-hour lunch in the middle of the day? Abba Chilkiyahu suggests that's improper. La Ragal Shono, you shouldn't have slander on your tongue. Vre Yaakov Avinu, this is Yaakov. This is an odd moment where we quote Yaakov, who says, as he is dressing up to deceive his father, "Maybe I'll be spotted and I shouldn't do this." We say, that's evidence that you shouldn't speak impropriety, you shouldn't lie or be deceitful. The end of the story is he does go on to deceive his father. But it is the impulse that I should not be doing this is what we're isolating as key. That's the purity. So even in that moment where Yaakov slips up, it's his internal world that we're pointing to. Don't always look at the way people behave, because the key is what we're attached to, and that attachment is what led Yaakov to thrive, and we should follow. You shouldn't do evil to your friend. So as Ronnie says, this is ironic coming from the author, but you shouldn't go down into your friend's business. So I guess to be somewhat loose with our language, that's quite, David does seem to get down into his friend's business, so to speak. But this is suggesting, again, is it legal? Say, look, it's a free market. You open your store, I'll open my store, and we'll see who wins out in the market. And the suggestion is, economically, you're right. By market policies, you're right. But really, commitment to community means I'm going to find another way. I'm going to compromise and make space for you to thrive, even though we're going to share, even though in theory we could share a business. So that's what it means, don't do bad to your friend. For the record, parenthetically, that's kind of what's going on with Hechsherim in Queens at the moment. If any of you have heard about there being issues, the Vard of Queens is combating and various restaurants are losing Hechsherim, getting a new Hechsher, and the Hechsher seems kosher. What's the problem? One of the issues that the Vard of Queens is one of the Hechsherim that is trying to come in is, you're gonna divvy up Queens and turn it into a place where it's the Wild West of Hechsherim. And it could be that a Hechsher will come in and say, "We're 100% kosher." And the Vada Queens might say, "Yeah, technically speaking, but what you're doing is you are fracturing the community in a way that will make it, no one will trust. Did you eat in that restaurant? I don't know. I don't trust that Hechsher. I trust that Hechsher. Am I gonna eat here? I don't rely on that." And right now, it's rather unique that you can go into almost any restaurant that's kosher and know that it's all one heksher. And if you eat in that restaurant, you eat in any restaurant. And this is, again, the principle. So if somebody says, well, is it good heksher? That's a complicated question. Meaning, is the food treif? Maybe not, but that doesn't mean it's a good heksher, so to speak. So this is, again, what are the principles beneath the halachic commitments we have? One is, lo aseh l'ro ra'ah. Don't do evil to your peers. Meaning, don't tear society asunder for economic interest, even if it seems all above board. Nivze be'inav nimas. If something is, Cherpa lo nasal krovo, do not permit reproach to your kin. Zem akarvet krovav. This is an interesting principle. Be good to your family. You'd think, right, that's just kind of a natural innate thing, but why should I do that? In fact, I think it was Montesquieu, the French Enlightenment thinker, who said, if we were honest and we took our commitment to humanity properly, nobody ethical would have friends. Why would you not have friends? What possible immorality could you put on the idea of having friends? What do you mean?
Even if it's hurtful.
Oh, interesting. So that could be a detail of how friendship should function. But what about even if you're honest and you've got friends and you're just always honest with each other?
Takes away from family.
Okay, it could be it takes away from family. It's essentially setting up particular commitments, meaning it's saying, I prefer this person because of personal reasons over somebody else. And if you're truly committed to humanity, I shouldn't have preferential relationships with anybody. I should be entirely transactional with every human being and treat them all with equal dignity and not have any particular attachment. I like you, I don't like you. That is a primitive, almost animal attachment to my own cravings and instincts as opposed to a commitment ethically to all human beings equally. That was his assumption here. The pushback from David is, no, you should bring family close. You should be attached to those who are committed to you, and that actually makes society well. And Rabbi Sacks, again, puts a huge emphasis on this in his moral writing, that through our love of particular people, we come to love universal humankind. It doesn't work the other way. You can't say, oh, I'm attached to all humanity, and then through loving human beings, I'll come to treat each individual well. That turns everything into an abstraction. It's through loving actual people that we come to have respect for other people, and that, again, seems to be the force here. But now we have a pushback to that pushback, which is David says, bring those who are close to you close. Love your family, love your friends. But, and this is Steve's point, nivze be'inav nim'as, but if something is repulsive or despicable, you should reject it. You shouldn't say family's family at all costs or friends are friends at all costs. And this is hard. If a good friend does something improper, at what point do you say I'm done? At what point do you say, well, I'm committed to my friend? And the same is true of family, and I imagine the bar's higher there. But if a family member does something horrific morally, it's hard to assess when am I betraying my commitment to family if I say I can't support you anymore. And here we've got an extreme example. What does it mean if something's repulsive to reject it? Ze Chizkiyahu HaMelech. This is talking about Chizkiyahu, the king. What did he do? Girar atzmot aviv b'mita shel chavalim. When his father died, he dragged his corpse over a bed of ropes because he was committed to idolatry during his reign. And this was his own father. And there's no indication that he had been abused by his father or he had been neglected by his father. And his father did anything other than love his son and want him to take over his dominion. And he said, but you're right, but what you did was despicable, and I need to reproach that, which is, again, an extreme example. Keep going. Yirei Hashem Yechabed, those who fear God you should honor. Zeh Yehoshaphat Melech Yehuda, this is talking about another king of Israel. Shebashah Shayirot Tom Chacham, when he saw a sage, Haya Omed Mikiso, he would stand up, and as a king, it was actually forbidden for you to stand in the presence of other people because it would threaten the authority of the state. But if he saw a wise scholar, he would stand up from his chair, Mechabko, and embrace him, Menashko, kiss him, Vakarilo, and call out, Rebbe, Rebbe, Mari, Mari. My teacher, my master, some say he said my father too. That principle is respecting those who revere God. You think, what has that got to do with a flourishing society or justice? But actually, reverence for authority holds society together in key ways. If you commit to something, do not change your mind. Again, we're giving Abraham, Yaakov, or Avraham, Yaakov, Chilkiyah, Abba Chilkiyah, Rav Safra, two kings of Rabbi Yochanan are our models. Rabbi Yochanan, when he would see somebody he didn't want to speak to, he would say, I'm sorry, I don't have time. I've committed to fast until I get home, and I'm really hungry, so I need to go home. I can't really talk to you right now. This came up in Tarnit. And he just didn't want to talk to them. So technically, it wasn't a real neder. He didn't really mean it, and it was just a kind of way to gently break to this person. He didn't want to speak to them. But yet he committed not to eat until he got home, even though he knew that he wasn't bound by it. Again, your word being your bond is key to society flourishing, even though technically speaking, no one is hurt. No one got upset. They weren't offended. I could just eat. Doesn't matter. Your word is key. And if you don't give weight to your word, I don't know how many times this has been in film or on stage or in history. Someone says, I give you my word. I'm sure in 24, every 3 minutes, Jack Bauer would say, I give you my word. And I said, 3 minutes ago, you just gave a word and then you just killed someone. We don't, why does that matter? If your word is nothing, society, there's no trust. Kasper lo natan b'neshach, you shouldn't give. Lend money with interest, afilu b'ribit goy, even to people who are not fellow citizens, meaning even to foreigners, which technically speaking, interest is perfectly permitted, you shouldn't even do that. And here the question arises as to, well, why not? What's wrong with, if it's perfectly permitted by Torah law, why shouldn't you do it? The Rivan on the right-hand side, who's replaced Rashi for the last few daf, says, because we're worried if you lend with interest to people who are not citizens, fellow citizens, you'll come to lend with interest to people who are citizens, but you're right, essentially there's no problem. Again, you could paint a very different picture. The interest is exploitative of people in need, and you can lend to Jews with interest with heter iske if it's through business propriety, but on a personal level, someone's in need of money, it's prohibited to lend them with interest if they're fellow citizens, and we say we shouldn't do that to anybody, really. If you want society to flourish, v'shochad anaki lo lakach, and we said you shouldn't take a bribe. Gagon Mishra Bar Yossi, for example, the case of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yossi. And what happened with Shmuel Bar Yossi, on the right-hand side in the Rivan, he details the story. Shmuel Bar Yossi used to get paid every week by a sharecropper. Sharecropper, somebody who would use his farm and say, you don't want a farm, you own land, let's make a deal here. I'll do the farming, I'll use your land, and in payment, I'll give you 10% of whatever I get off the ground. That's a sharecropper. And every week, he would bring him a nice basket of fruit on Friday for Shabbos to say, this is my payment for the week of what I got from your land. One week on Thursday, he came to Shmuel Bar Yossi and gave him the basket of fruit. Says, it's Thursday, usually come on Friday, what are you giving this to me? Well, I said, well, I have a case before the court today anyway, so I had to be in town on Thursday. So I thought, you know what, I won't schlep twice, I'll bring it to you now instead of tomorrow. And Shmuel Bar Yossi was going to be on the court that day, and he said, I have to recuse myself. And we know the Supreme Court today has very high standards in terms of recusal and potential conflict of interest. This was his fruit. It was owed to him. It was going to be given to him tomorrow. This was not bribery. I was giving you something that you shouldn't have had. It was given a day earlier. And he said, I can't sit on the case. And again, in the Rivan, he quotes the story that's taken from another Masechta. Rav Shmuel Bar Yossi says, and he was sitting in the audience that day listening to the case. And as the case was unfolding, he said, my sympathies went to the sharecropper's argument. I started favoring him. And I thought to myself, wow, it's my food. It was owed to me. And it wasn't really bribery. And nonetheless, I'm being kind of swayed by this. So can you imagine people who do take bribes, how much they're swayed by this? And this is, he is again, the standing model of an example of how society should function. A judge could turn around and say, technically speaking, this is perfectly above board. There was no need for me to declare or recuse myself, and I can cope. And Shmuel Bar Yossi is saying, nobody should think that they're above this if you're committed to society working. And again, that doesn't mean if one doesn't adhere to this, that they're depraved and immoral. It just means that the high standard being set here is being flaunted. And because this is such a high standard, we now lead into the following remark. David finishes the psalm by saying, if you do this, you will thrive and never shake forever. When Gamliel got to this verse, he would cry. Why would he cry? Amar manda avid lele kulhu hu lo yemot. Hachadim lo yemot. It sounds like if you do these things, you'll be fine. He said, all these things? We're trying to get it down from 613. We're at 11. But he said, the way we've just painted this with these models of moral commitment, who can do all of these things all the time? If I do one of them, I'll be lucky. And that suggests I'm not going to be a stable citizen. if I only do one of these? And the Gemara responds by essentially saying, no, we know it's impossible, but doing one is probably enough or not insignificant. Amrulay, they responded to him. Miktiv ose kol ele. It doesn't say do ose kol ele, all these things. Just say do these. Ose elektiv, afilu b'chadum no. Even if you do one of them, that's good. Dilotemach, and if you don't say elektiv achorena, there's another verse in Vayikra that says, al titamu b'chol ele, in the context of commitments against impurity. It says, don't become impure with all these things. Does that mean you can get impure with some of them, just not all of them? No, b'chol means with any of these things. Hatamnami anoge b'chol ele hu mitamme, b'chad menau lav, ele lav b'chol ele, hachanoi b'chol mekol ele. As long as you do one, you are on the path to being a committed citizen. Even so, Yeshua said, okay, David, that's 11. That's not enough. We need to start paring it back even more. And in the commentaries, there is a lot of concern about this sounding a lot like another faith that came along and said, all these laws, let's get rid of them and let's start paring it down. And it sounds like after a whole Masechet devoted to committed Jewish law, we're saying, let's scrap this, we can't cope. And how do I come to terms with it? And there's a lot of gymnastics done as to what's been happening here. But I think that the easiest of those options is that we're talking about the conceptual principles that motivate our commitment to all these laws. And again, it began with, there are 613, they're all binding, was given by Moses, and they stick. And if you think, all right, I'll buy that for now, the bottom of the Amud has the Gemara saying, and there were four times that Moshe said something, and later prophets said, scrap that, Mavatlet, which gets the red flags and red alarm bells going even more. But we'll, again, read it through the lens of what are the principles that drive our commitment. So Yeshua says, let's only do six. Dechtiv, it says in 33 of the book of Isaiah, Holech tzedakot, walk in justice. Dover mesharim, speak upright. Moes bebetzem ashkot. Reject exploitations. Refute bribery. Otem osno mishmo damim. Close your ears up from hearing blood. Otsem enav meraran. Close your eyes from seeing evil. So what are these six things? Number one, halak sakot, walk in justice. Ze Avram Avinu. So Yeshua says again, everything goes back to honest Abe, to Avram Avinu who walks in justice. And impurity. Avram was committed to justice. What does it mean to speak upright? Don't shame people in public. This is hard to do. We can't always judge when what we do will be embarrassing to other people. And we could, in theory, just say, never speak, because I don't know what's going to embarrass it. But we have to do our best to commit to not embarrassing people intentionally in public. We should refute anything which may look like impropriety. Kagon Bishma ben Elisha, and here we've got Bishma ben Elisha. On the right, you've got the example of this, which was, Bishma ben Elisha was a Kohen. Kohanim get a number of things. What did Kohanim get from the public? Say again?
Maaser.
Part of Maaser, or they get Trumat Maaser, and they get Truma.
Part of the Korban.
Part of the Korbanot, the Matno Kahuna, the three things, the jaw, the arm, and the stomach. They also get respect. They get to bench first. They get the first aliyah. And they also get reshit hagez. What's reshit hagez? The first shearing. So when you shear sheep, the first measure of that shear goes to the kohanim as well, because they need to eat and keep warm. So somebody came to Rishma ben Elisha, says, you're a Kohen, right? Says, great. I've been schlepping around. I'm here on business. I've got my reshit hagez on my back. Can you take it, please? And he said, well, where are you from? And they met in Miami, of course. He said, oh, I'm from Jamaica States. And Rishman Elisha said, well, don't you know Kohanim in Jamaica States? He said, well, I do, but I'm here now. And he said, well, give it to somebody in Jamaica States. And was it illegal to give it to him? No. Was it perfectly right to give it to him? Yes, he's a Kohen. But he says, I don't want to interfere and take away from what somebody else may be expecting or used to get. Again, technically speaking, transactional terms, perfectly legal. Market economy, nothing wrong with this. But there are commitments we have beyond what looks like direct harm that props up society. That's another example. Noah, kapav mitmach v'shochad, we shouldn't take bribery, so we come back to Rishul ben Rabbi Yossi. Yeshayahu holds on to that example from David HaMelech, remembering not to take bribes. Otem azna mishmo damim, we should block up our ears from hearing, what is damim? Bloods. It seems to be translated here as Dom mim, which means silences. You shall block up your ears from hearing silences, which means do not remain silent in the face of injustice. You shouldn't hear people throwing accusations at honorable scholars and remain quiet. You should protest. Kagon Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, who protested whenever he heard somebody saying bad things about rabbis, apart from one occasion. There's a long Agadic story which is being condensed into here. When he passed away, his body was essentially immaculate, didn't decay, was untouched, apart from one point where his wife saw one worm crawling on his ear and said, "Oh my gosh, what's going on?" And then she had a dream, and he said, "There was one time I heard somebody being rude to a rabbi and I didn't protest." So that's an example of how often one should protest if somebody's being unfair to somebody who deserves honor. You should not let your eyes see anything wicked. And he put it this way: one should not be looking. His view was you shouldn't look at women while they are standing doing laundry. And that is the example of not looking at bed. Why, particularly when women are doing laundry, one shouldn't be looking? Different commentaries on this.
They're facing their eyes.
They're doing it at the river, and they're going their bare feet.
How about they're not wearing clothes because they're wandering?
Okay, so those are all good options, or bad options, whatever you want to call it. The art scroll note says because they would do it at the river, which meant lifting up their skirt to keep their skirts dry, and then you'd see their legs. And then the note says, and ordinarily, what can you do if you see a woman come in? You can look down, so you don't have to look. But if you look down here, you'll see the legs, which would be the problem. Again, that kind of embedded reading, in theory, if you ordinarily see a woman, what can you do?
Look up.
Yeah, look at her. But if, you know, if her skirt's up, it might be that your eyes would be drawn down. But either way, the assumption here is it illegal to look? I think Jackie Mason may have a small bit about this when there was a court case that unfolded about somebody who was looking at a woman sitting next to him in a restaurant and he got fined because he was gazing at her rather than looking. And Jackie Mason is a bit like, what's the difference between gazing and looking? The judge said 20 seconds. He said the guy didn't have a watch. He thought he was looking. He didn't know he was gazing, whatever the case is. So is it illegal? No, but there's an assumption that, again, restraint is key. And it should be worth noting that often in Jewish culture, when it comes to issues of modesty, who do we assume is responsible for making society modest? Women. We assume cover yourself up. And what's the assumption here is not don't do laundry at the river or get your skirt wet to save the men, but men don't look. And that restraint is part of our commitment to culture as well, which sometimes goes by the wayside in life.
You do it laundry and you don't have spare clothes, they're going to be naked.
Yeah, so that's Jay-Zu as well. So you should avoid looking and taking advantage of people's vulnerability. And again, if you look at it through that prism, it's also got a component here that you are dehumanizing somebody and saying, I'm going to look at what I want. Forget that this person is doing this and in this state because they're in need. And my response could be, they don't have any spare clothes, I should help. But instead, I'm going to take advantage for my needs or my impulses. Again, restraint, patience, humanization, those are kind of the themes that emerge, which do not obfuscate the need for these commandments, but they just buttress them. Theologically and philosophically. First one line is Al Hakfisa Uktiv, and it says, Humaramim Shushkon, Yeshua says, whoever commits to these six things, you'll make your way up to the mount. Ba Mika, Vamidin Al Shalosh. Mika says, okay, six is great, we need it down to three. Let's get this down. Dichtiv, it says, Higid lecha Adam Ma Taval Ma Hashem Daresh Mimcha. What is it that God wants from you, said Mika? Ki Im, these are the only three things God wants from you. Number one, Asot Mishpat, do justice. Avat Chesed, love kindness, hasne lechid Hashem Elokecha, walk modestly with the Lord your God. And again, those are the key themes. Do what's just, commit to law, but that's not enough. Commit to kindness, going beyond the letter of the law. And not only should you proactively do more, we should also proactively do less than you might want to that's officially legal. Have humility, have modesty, have restraint. Asot mishpat zeh hadin. do justice, that's the law. Avat chesed, zugumalot chasadim, love kindness, that's proactively doing kind things. Hasneh lechet, what does it mean to go with modesty? And this is difficult for the commentators. Zahotzat hamet v'achnasat kala. This is talking about burying the dead and welcoming the bride. How is that the meaning of and walk humbly? I don't have a perfect resolution. There are different readings, one of which is our instinct on these occasions is to be flamboyant, to say, oh, we're burying the dead. We should be a hugely expensive coffin and a hugely expensive ceremony and a massive eulogy. And when welcoming a bride, it should be a massive wedding and a huge party. And our instinct should be to restrain ourselves in these circumstances in particular. That's one reading of this. Vahalo, dvarmka, in theory, you could also say differently. So, you know, it takes restraint to participate in these things if you're not directly tied to it, because I've got other instincts and other needs and other interests. And if somebody's welcoming a bride, very nice for them. What's that going to do with me? So restrain yourself and participate. Recognize that burying the dead and welcoming the bride is propping up society, even if it's not always what you feel like doing at that moment. Valadram kavachomen, is it not a kavachomen? Madram shedain dachan asabitsina, that these things which we don't usually define as involving modesty. Amra Torah, atzneh lecha, the Torah says you should do it. Dvarim shedachan asabitsina, alacha v'kama. So the things we usually do modestly with humility, all the more so we should do our best. Chazi Yishev Amed on Ashtayim. Yishayu said three is not good enough. Let's get it down to Shnei Makom Hashem. God says two things. Shimu Mishpat Ustaka. Keep justice and do what's righteous. Amos Ramin Achat. Amos said, okay, we can get it down to one. Shnei Maris, it says, Kom Hashem of Israel. This is what God says to Israel. Two words. One principle for the spirit of the whole of Jewish life. Dirshuni, seek me out, Vichiyu, and you will live. That seems to be the spiritual principle at the core of Jewish life. Seek out God and you will live. Which again pushes against, in theory, the mystical notion that what should we be trying to do is get away from earth, seek out God by death, seek out God and life on earth will be better. Markal of Renachma responded, Ema, well, hold on, that verse isn't very helpful, because in theory you could explain the word Dershuni as keep all the mitzvot and make it very technical. Obligation. Dishuni b'chola Torah. That's what you might assume it means. Kula. Elabach Chabakuk v'minachad. A better verse, if you're looking for the spiritual principle at the core of Jewish life, says, Rav Nachman Yitzchak, is from Chabakuk, which is, for tzaddik be'emunato yichyeh. Because it's none to do with law, per se. Everything to do with faith. That the righteous, through their faith, will live. That if you are committed to a benevolent master beyond nature, if you're committed to God, life will thrive. Okay, that's the end of the summaries. There are four decrees that Moses made that Nevi'im came later and nullified. Number one, Moshe Amav Yishkan Yisrael Bezach Badad En Yaakov. Moshe said, if you want to be like Yaakov, you should live alone. And this speaks to the point we raised earlier. Segregate yourself, insulate yourself, go into a cave. That's what Moshe seems to do. But Amos Vitla, Amos comes along and says, don't do that. He says, stop that. Who can be like Yaakov? And it says that God agreed with him. A time comes to fall apart. And in the Chashukei Chemed, Reb Zilberstein, he says on his commentary on this page, okay, so if one's setting up a life, should one decide to live alone? If win the lottery, what should you do? Should you go and live by yourself in the countryside and spend your day in study? Or should you live in the middle of a city? You know where there's going to be more temptation. And it seems to be Moshe would have said, live on your own. And the later prophets come along, Amos in particular, and says, that's not a way to live. We should really integrate ourselves in the city. Moshe, Amr, Moshe says, Ragoyim, Hahim lo targia, you will find no rest when you are dispelled amongst the nations. Israel. He says, actually, Israel can find rest. There is a way in which we can accommodate to being in exile and thrive. Moshe says that the children will be punished for the behavior of the parents. But Yechezkel, Vitla, Yechezkel comes along and says, no, ha-nefesh ha-choteh itamot, only the sinner will be held accountable, not the later generations. Moshe amavad begoyim. Moshe says, you will perish among the nations. By Shayo v'ama Yeshua came along and said, v'ayaba humi yitka b'shofa gadol, and we will carry uvo ha-uvdim ba'aretz, and all those who have been lost will be gathered in. So it sounds like Moshe says, if you get exiled, you'll all be lost and perish. And the response from Shayahu is, those who are lost will be gathered in. So it sounds like you won't perish. So again, we've got correctives to what seems like incredibly harsh pronouncements from Moshe, where the letter prophets reconstitute or revise the meaning of what Moshe means in those pronouncements. Amar Rav, Rav says, Mr. Fina Mahay Krav Avadik Begoyim. He says, I'm terrified about that verse where Moshe said, you will perish among the nations. And Michael of Rapapa, Rapapa says, well, don't be terrified. Maybe there's another way we can read that. We don't have to view this pushback to Mishayahu as a nullification, just a revision in the following way. Dilma ka aveda mitbakeshet, maybe like a lost article. Anyone's ever lost anything? You say, well, I lost my phone. Nobody means my phone has perished. By, you know, if you say I lost my grandmother, that you probably don't mean I can't find her. But the word's ambiguous. So I lost my phone doesn't mean, what can you do? I lost my phone. It means you find it. So maybe when Moshe says, Avadid Abagoyim will be lost among the nations, it doesn't mean you'll perish, but it means there'll be some searching to do to find your way back. Maybe that's what it means. And his response was, and he says, maybe that's what it means. That word is used in the context of like having lost your phone or a sheep. And he says, well, what about the end of the verse? He says, V'achla atem eretz avechem, that the land of your enemies will eat you. Matkiv Lai's response from Mazutra was, Dilmaka achila kishun vidun. Maybe it's like eating cucumbers and gourds. How does one eat cucumbers and gourds? The word, put this in ways that we might understand in Jamaican States, is if I said, you'll be eaten like a kiddish in the lands of your enemies, you think, oh my gosh, we're going to get completely swept up. I don't know if what it's seen like, what is kiddish, Shabbos morning, it's gone. If I said, you're going to be eaten like shashudas in the land of your enemies, don't know if you've seen how much is left over every week, you have a lot of confidence. All right, we'll lose some. Most of us will be left. So the assumption is maybe something will be consumed in the land of your enemies. It just means that, you know, people will eat into you, but not that you will be entirely consumed. Full stop. Last two stories, we're only going to do one. And it once happened, Rabbi Yekiva were walking Baderach, Vishimukol Amonashal Romi, and they could hear the sound of Rome from Birchok Mever Esra Mil. They were 120 milim away, and they could hear the joy in the streets of Rome. Anyone ever been to Rome? Anyone ever flown from Rome to Israel? Yeah, the fact that you flown, tells you it's not round the corner. And they could hear from the streets of Israel the joy in Jerusalem, which again is not suggesting miraculously, but meaning they're standing in Jerusalem, which had been emptied out, hollowed out, burnt out and destroyed. And they knew that Rome was a place of joy. The markets were thriving. The community was on the rise. The empire was coming into its own. And they're thinking, how can we respond to this? Hitchilu bochin, they started to cry. Rabbi Kiva masachek, Rabbi Kiva was laughing. Amrilu menei masachek, they said, what are you laughing about, Rabbi Kiva? Amrilu matem ipnei matem bochim, says, what are you crying about? Amrilu halu goyim shemishtachim latsevim mekatrin levodazor. These idolatrous peoples, Yerushalayim bedek vashket, they're living in peace and security. Va'anu beis hadom raglei lokenu, and we are in the house of God that has been burnt by Eish in fire. Lo nifken, we shouldn't cry. Amalehen says, Lakach nimisachek, that's why I'm laughing. Mala over Eretzonokach, just as those who breach God's law are living that way. Those who do as well, all the more so. On Shabbos, we'll finish the next story. But again, the assumption here, what is Rabbi Kiva saying? Saying, if those who breach God's law are living that way, all the more so we will. What is his argument? So the Nevuah will come in the next story. This is kind of chapter one. But let's put the Nevuah to the side for a minute. What is his assumption? Assumption that God is just. God responds to reward. And if those who don't keep God's law are doing so well, all the more so will do well. What could a cynic turn around and say? Say again? Well, so that's one cynical response. Is, well, very nice. I'll laugh when that happens. But right now I'm upset, you could say. You could also say, that whole calculation doesn't make any sense. If they're breaching God's law, they shouldn't be thriving at all. Not, oh, they're doing okay, and if we keep the law, we'll do okay. And there are a few ways to resolve that. One is, Akiva assumes God loves all people. And even though they're breaching God's law, he's propping them up. And if he's willing to prop up people because he loves them, even if they're not keeping his law, of course, he'll prop us up. Or if we're reading through the prism of, how do societies flourish? And he's saying, look, if people who are breaching the laws that we think are key centrally they're idolatrous, which is like the premise of what keeps society together, and they're managing to hold it together. Can you imagine what we can do with our commitment to it? Can you imagine how we can flourish as a people if given the opportunity geopolitically when we have commitments? Meaning they're committed to idols. They slaughter people in the gladiator houses. They've got no commitment to human dignity and human life across the board. And yet, their empire is thriving. They have prosperity and an economy. Imagine if we've got the chance, what we can do with society. And then we're going to have the next story, the famous one, when they see a fox flying out of the temple and Akiva's laughing, and they'll eventually find some solace. But we'll save that for Shabbos. But in the meantime, thank you. Chodesh Tov. Yosher Koach. We're becoming a coach with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. We're going to be a coach with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. We're going to be a coach with the Kodesh Baruch Hu.